Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. This week we are on the road, transporting you to the rather wonderful city of Madrid. As well as its world-class museums, lively tascas and top-scoring football club, the city is also home to one of the longest-running contemporary art fairs in the world. Arco Madrid is now in its 43rd year, and the fair holds a particular place in Spanish culture. It's a hugely important event not just for Madrid, but for the country as a whole. Consequently, it was fitting that the doors were opened by none other than the King and Queen of Spain last Wednesday. Arco is a market for the work of Spanish artists and the endeavours of Spanish galleries, as well as those from the rest of Europe. Plus, it has a rather unsurprisingly unique connection with the wider Hispanic world and Latino countries. Commercial interests, therefore, are balanced against carefully curated sections put together with clear editorial rigour. On today's show, we'll be hearing from the woman at the helm of the fair, as well as a curator in charge of a particularly striking artistic programme. Also, a Spanish gallery at a unique point of time in its history, and we'll meet the artist representing the country at this year's Venice Biennale. That's all coming up here on Monocle on Culture. Maribel Lopez is the woman who's brought together the 200-plus galleries that make up this year's fair. She's been in the role for 4 years, but her association with Arco stretches back much further, with stints as both marketing director and a programme curator. I caught up with a very chipper Maribel amidst the hustle and bustle of the fair. Here she tells me about how she balances the curatorial with that all-important requirement for an art fair, selling art to collectors.
That is one of the most interesting questions I've been asked, I have to say, because that's really something that concerns me, or I would not say concern, that it interests me. You know, this is an institution that it's a market, but it's also a place where many people come to learn. I came in my time, so, and in something that also means a lot for a structure such as the Spanish one, and also for the connections between Spain and the world itself, no? So it's a very interesting process. You know, we always work together with the galleries in trying to help them bring in the most curatorial projects possible. And to help them do that, what we do is think about the strategies that we can offer them in terms, very simple terms, commercial terms. So they have a booth that has a price, as every regular fair, but then we offer them a showroom, always behind closed doors, so where they can do whatever they want. So in this way, we allow them to have this kind of accrochage full of pieces to sell, and we push them to be more curatorial in their roots. In a way, my obsession, and it's becoming an obsession, is that at the end of the day, at some point, we manage that galleries work in Arco, in their booths, from 40 square meters to 150, as they work in their galleries.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. It's successfully done, and there's a nice rhythm as you go through the fair. At what point, as the director and with your committee members, do you know what's going to be on each booth? You know, do you kind of, because you have to, you have to think of the flow of the fair, and if there's a lot of figurative painting in one corner, you can't have, you need to mix up the sculpture, the contemporary, the this, that, and the other. How do you do that, and how, at what point in the process of planning for the next fair do you know what's going to be in the booths, I wonder?
Well, we know when the galleries present their projects, that's like 7 months in advance or eight, we have an idea of the artists they want to present. They have to share this with us. They do a render even, but we know that's going to change. But still, we have some ideas of the direction the booths are going to go. And then there's a lot of geopolitics involved also. You know, you have to consider whether two booths that are too similar might not be together, but also put together somehow galleries that have a possible dialogue between them, because that also helps for collectors to orientate.
And they might be terrible enemies, you see.
Yeah, so then you have to know enough historically not to put them face to face. You can put them next to each other, but not face to face. So those are all things that you learn during the years. And also the fair doesn't change so much. When a gallery is happy in their position, our tendency is to keep them there. You know, so that gives certain positions that everybody knows where some galleries are. That also helps orientate in such a big fair as this one. So that distribution, that is a very key part of the process and brings a lot of problems somehow and discussions and etc. is one of the most interesting because, of course, it's geopolitical. At the same time, it's kind of a curatorial approach, being, I mean, you know, putting myself in a very strong position, but it has also that approach, you know.
Talking of the geopolitics of it, that's obviously, that's inherent in a lot of the artworks and how the galleries work, and especially the globalized art world. You addressed that specifically in your Caribbean presentation. Your curators have chosen works and themes and galleries and artists really wonderfully there. But in the, to reference your earlier answer about the sort of new world, I suppose, the Spanish, Latin America and all the rest of it, do you see the sort of Spanish message or the Spanish cultural power pushing south, or do you see that power now coming back? And there's some wonderful galleries from Buenos Aires, Bogota, etc., etc. Do you see that wave having gone out? It's coming back in again now culturally?
Somehow, if you think in contents of the galleries, in quality, in challenges, in approaches of the artists, I think, yes, one of the things that makes Arco proud, that the representation and the presentation of the Latin American scenes, that is, they are so plural, are really getting stronger and stronger every year. And that really means for us that that connection is real. No? I mean, that was an impulse, a work for many years, and now it's happening. And also, we see how, like, galleries from Europe, because mostly Arco is composed by Spanish, Latin American, and European galleries, in full honesty, how those galleries also are getting more and more interest in the Latin American artists, etc. So, yes, that's for sure. And on the other hand, there's also the scene of collectors that changed dramatically the city, that changed dramatically for good the collector scene in the city, no? So all those, both those things, the artists and the collectors, I would say, is the wave back.
Nice. Now, you can feel that as well. There's a real excitement. There's a real... Everyone's speaking the same language, but they're speaking it slightly differently. And they've got slightly different dance moves, I suspect, right? It's only slightly. So, Maribel, we can hear the sort of Spanish hospitality hotting up around us, which is great. I just wondered, as you walk around the fair, you've got happy collectors, happy art dealers, maybe even happy journalists. But I wondered, what is success for you? How do you, if you're trying to achieve a certain vibe, how do you do that?
Well, that success is exactly that feeling, not that kind of atmosphere. There's something we really try to do very hard, and if it feels, it's because we're achieving it at least, is that how can we make this such an like historical fair and big fair, make everyone who enters feel they belong. That's key for us, no? So that the collector feels that there is a comfortable space and a very important piece for them, and the student finds that they can discover. So all that is part of this really very special thing of this fair that starts in the very gallery we select and to the last, you know, space for to drink wine that we create, no? In the part of the selection, it's true that it's something very intuitive in the whole process, but I think what we bear in mind is, the question is, will this work be future? Will this work be history of art? Of course, we are not that innocent. We know, you know, that there are more than 1,500 artists here. But that's a question that's in the atmosphere, and that gives also a certain background, a certain place to put your feet on, no, and feel secure.
Thank you indeed, Maribel Lopez, director of Arco Madrid. As I mentioned, there is a strong curatorial essence to Arco. One of those responsible is Carla Acevedo Yates, a curator at MCA Chicago, who selected works for a selection at Arco entitled The Shore, the Tide, the Current, and Oceanic Caribbean. Alongside her co-curator, Carla took a poetic approach to her thinking about the region, incorporating ideas of multiplicity, currents, and tides. And on display was the breadth of mediums used by some of the most interesting contemporary artists from the Caribbean. Speaking to me from within the architecturally enticing pink folds of her exhibition, here is Carla.
I think my personal experience growing up on an island has definitely shaped my curatorial practice and my interest in contemporary art. And I've always been interested in this idea of the metaphor and how that can shape a way you think about an artist's work or an exhibition space. I did grow up in a coastal town near the shore, and I really wanted that to be present in this exhibition as a metaphor to think about how identities are formed in relation to others, but also in a space of negotiation between two geographies, between what is liquid and solid, between the sea and the earth. So thinking about fluidity in terms of identity and how artists are negotiating that through their work.
And you do that beautifully here in the space here in Madrid. And you talk about the fluidity, the tide going in and out, and what is continental and what is oceanic. These are themes that you riff on. But these are borne out in really fascinating ways in the artworks. Looking around me, we are occasionally looking at figurative painting, but we're looking at, in terms of fluidity, we're looking at gender, we're looking at sexuality, we're looking at race and nationality and what people see when they look in the mirror. Could you broaden that out? Could you tell us a few of the ways in which the artists and the works that you've chosen have addressed these themes of time and tide, I suppose, as a theme that you've chosen?
One thing that has been important for us is to think about how Caribbean artists and their work has been perceived and how there has been historically an expectation for us Caribbean people to look a certain way, to behave a certain way, to produce a certain type of work. So there's this like burden of representation or a burden of geography or identity. And one thing that we wanted to express through the selection of works in this exhibition here in ARCO was the multiplicity and diversity of the artistic production produced both in the geographic Caribbean but also in the diaspora, and how artists are handling and approaching histories of colonialism and the legacies of colonialism today, but also defying expectations around what it is to be Caribbean. How does the Caribbean taste like? How does the Caribbean look like? And thinking about how identity and representation is negotiated within these multiple ways. And as you said, there's several queer identifying artists. There are several in the perimeter of the show, and that was really important for us to forefront because of ideas around the construction of gender, sexuality, and race within what is the structure of colonialism. But there's also artists thinking about climate injustice and how we relate in a different way to the environment, not in a non-exploitative way, and different ways of seeing the world that really come from an understanding of harmony between human nature and non-human forms.
And do you, in your work in Chicago and in the United States, do you see what the rest of the world, the Western world, quote unquote, thinks of Caribbean people and Caribbean art? You're in a really good position, being from Puerto Rico, but working in the United States, to see both sides of that, mm-hmm. to be looking down both ends of that telescope. How does that look to you, Carla?
There's a field of expectations around what the Caribbean is, where it is, for example, that's a good one, how we behave, how we're supposed to look like, and what type of work Caribbean artists and Caribbean curators do. And a part of it has to do with the fantasy and the imaginary that has been created around the region that has to do with the tourism industry. So a place of leisure, a place to take a vacation, to take a break from daily life, you know, the tropical drinks, coconut trees, like all of this different fantasy world that exists, but that exists within a very specific historical process that is a result of colonialism. And part of what I'm interested in doing, both in my work in Chicago, but also the work that I do outside of the museum, is really challenging those notions, challenging those stereotypes, and working with artists that are thinking through these contradictions in an interesting way, that are thinking about the legacies of colonialism and how they look today. Like I said in the essay, colonialism is not a thing of the past. It still has these ripple effects that we can see through environmental injustice and race and gender constructions. So I was interested in looking at these very different ideas through a group of artists that I find are working through them in fascinating ways.
I wanted also, Carla, to ask you about art production in the Caribbean, as broad a term as that is. Are there the requisite foundations, the requisite places to make and show and display and sell art and make a market and have a kind of curatorial general discussion within that part of the world that we call the Caribbean, I wonder.
It's a precarious infrastructure, so it's not comparable to, you know, major cities in the United States and Europe, and there's a lack of support. So in terms of the ecology of arts, there's a lot of, you know, spaces and initiatives that are started by artists themselves, and that has been very enriching for me personally because I did start as an independent curator doing everything on my own, so I know how to do everything in an exhibition.
How are your packing skills?
They're not great. Now that I work in a museum, I'm like, well, that wasn't great. But that speaks to our enthusiasm to do things no matter what. And we don't really depend on anybody to do things. But you are right to say that there is a lack of commercial infrastructure and even a collecting culture. A lot of people come to the Caribbean to perhaps buy very particular representations of the Caribbean that conform to those standards of beauty and the landscape that have been created and perceived for the pleasure of others. But at the same time, there's so many interesting artists working in the region. A lot of them study abroad. That's a fact. There are some artists and some that want to do and pursue master's degrees. And for example, in Puerto Rico, there's not a master's degree in fine arts, so artists have to go to the States. Usually they go to New York or Chicago. So that speaks to, you know, the lack of proper infrastructure in terms of education, but that also translates to the commercial sector.
That was Carla Acevedo-Yates. Now to turn to an exhibiting gallery, and it's one whose story has sort of just begun. Two of Spain's leading art galleries, Joan Prats Gallery and Nogueras Blanchard Gallery, have recently merged into one joint venture called Prats Nogueras Blanchard. The gallery will operate in Madrid and Barcelona, and this represents the first big gallery merger in the Spanish art world. Here's co-owner Alex Nogueras and how the two came together.
Galería Joan Prats was established in Barcelona in the late 70s, so it has nearly 50 years of history. Nogueras Blanchard was established 20 years ago in Barcelona as well. So we share some interests, conceptual interests, I would say. I also would say that maybe Joan Prats was more like a historical gallery based in painting, and we were more like conceptually based gallery. We've been working together for a while now. We've been doing projects together since the pandemic, summer pop-ups and so on. So we connected very well, and we decided to merge. So that happened literally a month ago.
That's good news. Congratulations on that happy marriage. It's a bit of a joke in the art world, I suppose, in the commercial art world, that there is, everyone goes for drinks together, but there's also a lot of competition, a lot of cutthroat competition. So this is a good news story. There obviously is a size of gallery that kind of can come together sort of happily. Is that what seems to have happened? I think my question is sort of framed in the kind of the sort of global art market, that smaller galleries, medium-sized galleries, it's sometimes tough in the big fairs to swim along with the big fish. Without wanting to put words in your mouth, I wondered if it's obviously an advantage for your two galleries to have come together.
Well, the situation you just described is obviously a concern to us, and it's been like that for a while. We feel also that since we opened like Nogueras Blanchard in 2004, the competition to get into the major art fairs has been fierce, no? And also there is like a generation gap. Like galleries that opened right before that, like in the 2000s and late 90s, they could access the big fairs fairly easily. And for us, galleries born in early 2000s, we followed the same route, the same circuit, and we never got in. And this happened to a lot of colleagues, no? Colleagues from Amsterdam, from France, from, you know, all over the world, that we keep doing the same fairs over and over until, like, I don't know, 15 years later, we're not young anymore. And we cannot do Liste anymore because, I mean, it's a matter of...
This is the Basel satellite fair.
Yeah, of course. So you realize that you're not a young gallery anymore. You're not so...
Alex, you speak for yourself. You look exceptionally well preserved.
Thank you. I'm 50. So this is an issue, no? And also, and that prevented us from growing as a gallery. I think this merge is thought of as something that will allow us to become bigger in the Spanish art market, which is a big market. It's a market that is somehow overlooked when you think of Europe, European, but then they're all here, you know? Like, you think of Paris Plus and last edition, there was only one gallery from Spain, and suddenly there's like all the French galleries are here.
No, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing because this obviously is this is a very major Spanish cultural event as well, right? So you've got Spanish galleries, great and small, here, and you've also got the Latin American collectors, and there feels like, and I mentioned this to Maribel, the fair director, there feels like curatorially in some of the thematic shows, but also in terms of the actuality and the experience of Latin American money and collectors coming back to the old country rather than always pushing south. Is that your experience to the people, the collectors that you work with and that buy your works?
South America was very important to Arco since the beginning, or at least in the last 10 years. It was since the time of the previous director, Carlos Urroz, he was always looking towards Latin America. In fact, I feel and I think, and this is my theory, my thinking, that when Art Basel Miami opened, it was a loss for Arco because it was a lost opportunity somehow. And I think they felt this. Of course, Basel in Miami in December is fantastic because it's such a nice weather. It's such a good idea. But then I think it's too much offer, it's too huge. And in the end, there's so many Latin American people that have a foot in Madrid. Obviously because of cultural links, but also because of the language, no? So it was always a very Latin American-oriented fair, I would say.
And we've been fortunate to be on the receiving end of some wonderful Spanish hospitality. There are more clinking wine glasses than coffee cups here. It's a nice place to be. What is the vibe for you? How would you define the atmosphere of this fair? Obviously, you're here to sell work and to meet your collectors and to meet your friends, and it's a great kind of crossroads. But what about the social side of it after a successful day on the booth? How do you celebrate, and how collegiate is that celebration?
I've been doing Arco for 20 years.
So you just go to bed.
I now go to bed, but I've been coming to Arco without going to bed, basically. That was in my early days. And I feel that people that work for me, I know they do this as well. So now it's the social side of Arco is huge. Also because of Madrid. Madrid is such a welcoming city. The nightlife in Madrid is amazing. And people are really, really, really open. No? So that's the one thing that we always say when we're here in Madrid. People actually open their homes. And they invite you to come over to see what they have. And they treat you really well as well. So they're really good hosts.
It's perfect. Well, it's a fantastic day, week, hour. I mean, it works really well. And as I say, the clinking of wine glasses can be heard in the background. So it's probably better we wrap up this interview, Alex. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
That was Alex Nogueras from the newly established Prats Nogueras Blanchard. And finally, on today's show, let's take a step away from the fair and into the airy studio of the artist Sandra Gamarra. Sandra was born in Lima, but has lived here in the Spanish capital for the past 20 years. While her studio might be centrally located in Madrid, spacious and light-filled, the work bears the mark of the more brutal parts of Spanish history. The works we're looking at will soon fill Spain's pavilion at the Venice Biennale, and Gamarra makes use of historic Western art, but also subverts and plays with these notions. She brings the idea of migration to the fore, whether that be the migration of people, plants, or raw materials. Standing in front of one large-scale painting, Sandra explains just what we're looking at.
This is a painting that are based on an original Franz Hals painting from the Thyssen collection here in Madrid. It's a family in a landscape, I think it's the real name of the painting. Recently, they understood that the family is a family to traffic with the slaves, and perhaps the little one kid, black kid, that is in the painting is one of these, is his servant, but perhaps he take him from Africa. In the original painting, his face is so dark, it's more part of the nature than the human part of the narration. No? And what I'm doing is to put all the painting in a way that we understand. I'm just starting with the painting, and only the face and the hands of the little one is finished, like we finished the history or that we finished the paintings. No, so what I'm doing is put my finger in those spaces of the painting that we usually don't see. No,
around the edge, there is sort of like almost framed around the edge are pieces of contemporary photography that look like they've been cut out from newspapers. Mm-hmm. It feels like the history is being brought up to date. There are some, there's a child on a, laboring on a building site down there, for example. What are these? This feels like the painting being finished with contemporary news footage.
What I wanted to understand is that part of the history that we, our way of think the time that the progress line is not necessarily a line, maybe it's a circle, and we are repeating the same behaviors with different layers, no? With different skin. But maybe painting is one of these layers that permit ourselves to keep repeating these kind of behaviors with varnish that don't permit ourselves to see what a contemporary is, for example, right now, a slave, in this particular painting.
Yeah, we have a phrase in English as well, which is varnishing the truth. Yeah. And it feels like that very much in the formal way of oil painting.
Perfect for that. For me, it's important to show how we naturalize the colonialism past and how they are working here, working right now in the same way, but so naturalized that we and I'm talking about me, we are part of the same past in the present, and we don't really know how much we are doing.
So there's an idea of habit, right? The habit of naturalizing and normalizing, I suppose, the idea of colonialism. A lot of the works that you're referencing are pieces of kind of classics of art history, I suppose, the sort of old masters and Velázquez, Frans Hals, etc., etc. This is the point at which perhaps colonialism, Spanish colonialism, started in South America, maybe even earlier. Are you saying that there is a line to be drawn between this era of painting and the current day, that colonialism, in effect, hasn't stopped?
Yeah, because I think painting is a kind of teacher in the way we see, in the way we understand nature, people, and objects. And I have this kind of idea that maybe through painting, we can deactivate this way to see the world, not to destroy our way of life, but to be better. I think the problem is not what happened with the other. I think maybe if we incorporate the other inside of us, this uncomfortable of this fight can be first made inside of everyone.
That was Sandra Gamarra, who's representing Spain at this year's Venice Biennale. And that is it for this week. My thanks to all of this week's interviewees. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in. ¶¶